normal rate. Under these arrangements, they get more dough if they do a lot of work, but you pay less than if they were on an hourly rate. Whatever minimum you work out, it will be against, meaning a prepayment of, the percentage. If you do a percentage deal, many business managers will accept a maximum fee, called a cap. You should always ask for this, particularly when they're charging you a minimum. The cap will vary with the amount of money you earn and the amount of work you require. They're generally around $150,000 to $300,000 per year, which means if you're paying 5%, you're earning $3 million to $6 million a year. Minimum fees for people in this range are about $30,000 to $125,000 per year. When you make a percentage deal, it should only apply to money received, not earned, while the business manager is involved. Also, ask if it applies to investment income. With some business managers, it does, while with others, it doesn't. If the business manager is farming out investments to independent advisors, as most of them do these days, I would try not to pay a percentage of investment income. If you don't do a percentage fee deal, most business managers charge an hourly rate. In this case, spell out what the rate is, and be sure they tell you the rate for everyone involved, not just the top people. Sometimes, if the business manager is young and hungry, or if you have a lot of clout, he or she may be willing to take a flat fee for all services, regardless of the amount of work. Often, it's a flat fee for normal services, plus an additional amount for touring work, which is reasonable, because touring takes an enormous amount of time and resources. Listen again. Let me say this one more time. Be extremely careful in picking your business manager. More careful than you are with anyone else on your team. This is the person who can make sure you have a cozy old age or leave you playing supermarket openings in your 50s. Your half of the job. But as important as picking the right business manager is your own attitude. I remember seeing one of Elvis Presley's bodyguards at a press conference. A reporter asked why he didn't stop Elvis from taking drugs. His answer, "How do you save a man from himself?" That answer really hit me. I've always felt it was one of the most telling statements about an entertainer's life. If you don't care about your financial future, it's difficult for anybody else to. If someone is constantly telling you not to do something, like spend money, and you really want to do it, you'll probably get rid of them rather than listen. Remember Dick Gregory's quote. Refer back to Chapter 2. If you're going to spend everything you make, then start spending money you don't have, you're going to end up broke. It's that simple. And it doesn't matter how much you earn. So don't do it, unless you subscribe to my partner Chuck Scott's philosophy. The best way to build a small fortune is to take a large one and dwindle it down. Few things last forever, and an assured stream of earnings at your highest level is not one of them. So even the best business managers can't help you if you overspend on jets, yachts, houses, cars, and controlled substances. I know, you're listening to this and saying it will never apply to you, but only you can make sure it doesn't. Chapter 5. Attorneys. See the cartoon and caption from The New Yorker in the accompanying PDF. Now for a subject close to my own heart. It's hard for me to be totally objective about this one, but I'll try. Picking a lawyer. Role. Attorneys in the music business do much more than just look over contracts and advise clients about the law. They're very involved in structuring deals and shaping artists' business lives. Lawyers have evolved into one of the most powerful groups in the music industry, odd as that may sound to you. The reason is that the power bases in the music business aren't concentrated in any one group. For example, in the film business, the major agencies are the most powerful players. In the music biz, the agents are powerful, but but limited in their sphere of influence, as we'll see in the next chapter. Personal managers are very powerful, but the nature of their job limits the number of clients they can take. Business managers can have a lot of major clients, but they deal only in limited financial areas and are therefore not power bases. Lawyers, on the other hand, are involved in all areas, and because the time required for each client is less than that of a personal manager, they can handle more clients. This means the attorneys end up seeing more deals than anyone else, and therefore have more knowledge of what's going down around town. Consequently, they can be influential in determining which company will get a particular deal, which means the companies want to keep them happy. They can also influence which personal manager and which business manager get a client, which means these guys also want to keep the lawyers happy. This means lawyers have power and are happy. Style. There are distinctly separate styles of attorneys in the music business. Some are into hanging out and acting as if they're one of the band members, while others stick to the business side. There are power broker/agent types who are good negotiators, but not particularly good lawyers, and excellent lawyers who lose sight of the big picture. And of course, there's a whole spectrum in between. Using the techniques in Chapter 2, first assure yourself you're talking to a good, competent lawyer. After that, the matchup of style is mostly a matter of your personal taste. For example, if you like flash, you may want a flashy lawyer, although I find it more often that flashy artists like their lawyers to be staid and solid. If you're honest and straightforward in your business dealings, be sure to get an honest and straightforward lawyer. Your references will tell you who is and isn't. If you aren't, there are, unfortunately, lawyers to match you. Clout. It's true that a lawyer with clout can get through to people that other lawyers can't, or at least they can get through faster. Indeed, one of the major things to look for in a lawyer is his or her relationships in the industry. Let me illustrate with a story about remodeling my house. Over the years, I went through a number of house remodels, always looking for the cheapest possible price, which means dealing directly with the workmen. I finally got sick of that process, so I broke down and hired a contractor. During this job, for the first time, I realized the value of a general contractor. In the past, whenever I called up a tile man, electrician, plumber, etc., these people couldn't have cared less about me. They came to my job when it was convenient for them, if ever. If my sink leaked for a few days, they didn't care, because they had a lot of other customers. On the other hand, when the contractor called, they jumped. The reason was pretty simple. If they didn't satisfy the contractor, they didn't just lose one job, they lost their next year's work. The same applies to lawyers. Record companies can't ignore phone calls from important lawyers, nor can they afford to treat them shabbily in any particular transaction. The reason is the same as with the contractor. They're going to be dealing with the lawyers over and over, and they don't want to make enemies of them. So a lawyer with good relationships will get your deals done quicker, and if they know what they're doing, will get you the maximum that can legitimately be had. You should also know what clout doesn't do. There is only so much you can get from any particular deal, regardless of who is asking. If a record company doesn't like your music, they're not going to sign you because of your lawyer. If they're hot for you, you'll get a deal even if you're represented by Kim Jong-un. Put another way, the real clout is your musical talent. Note, I'm not talking about a lawyer's experience and knowledge. That is truly valuable and will indeed get you the maximum from the negotiation. But you should have a perspective on the hyped-up importance of clout. Loose lips. Be especially wary of a lawyer who tells you about other clients' lives. Some lawyers, for example, will tell you exactly what deal they got for a specific client. Apart from the fact that this violates the attorney's canon of ethics, it also means that they will be telling other people about your deal. It may appear that these people trade confidential information for secrets they wouldn't otherwise have, but in fact, the opposite is almost always the case. Everyone knows they have a big mouth, so they're only told things that people want spread around. Fees. Most lawyers in the music business don't charge on just an hourly basis. For the ones that do, the rates are from $300 plus per hour for new lawyers, up to $1,000 or more for biggies. Some of us charge a percentage, usually 5%, while others do something known as value billing, often with an hourly rate or retainer against it. A retainer is a set monthly fee, like the business manager's minimum fee, discussed in Chapter 4, and it's either credited against the ultimate fee, or it's a flat fee covering all services. Value billing means that, when the deal is finished, the lawyer asks for a fee based on the size of the deal and his or her contribution to it. If the lawyer had very little to do with shaping the deal, but rather just did the contract, the fee should be close to an hourly rate, though I'll get heat for telling you this because it's usually more. On the other hand, if the lawyer came up with a clever concept or strategy that made you substantial money, or the lawyer made the introduction, or created the deal from scratch, he or she will ask for a much larger fee. If your lawyer value bills, you should ask in advance what the fee is likely to be, so there won't be any rude surprises. Sometimes you can pre-negotiate the fee based on results. For example, if I get you X, you'll pay me Y. If I get you 2x X, I get Z. At a minimum, get a ballpark range. Conflicts of interest. A lawyer has a conflict of interest when his or her clients get into a situation where their interests are adverse, i.e., opposing each other. This is easy to see, for example, when two clients of the same lawyer want to sue each other. However, it's also a conflict when two clients of the same lawyer make a deal with each other. Lawyers are ethically required to disclose their conflicts of interest to you. Your choice is either to hire another lawyer or to waive, meaning you choose to ignore the conflict and continue to use the same lawyer. Because the entertainment industry is a relatively small business, those of us who practice in this field are continually bumping into ourselves when our clients make deals with each other. Most of the time, these situations are harmless and can be handled simply, in one of several ways. 1. Each of the clients gets another lawyer, rare unless it's a pretty serious conflict. 2. One of the clients gets another lawyer, much more common. 3. The clients work out the agreement among themselves, or else the manager, agent, or business manager negotiates for them, and the lawyer merely draws up the paperwork, not representing anyone's interest. When interviewing attorneys, you should ask if they have or foresee any conflicts of interest. Most ethical lawyers will bring it up before you do, but you should ask anyway. For example, your lawyer might also represent your record company, your merchandiser, your personal manager, producer, publisher, etc. It's not uncommon for a personal manager to recommend his or her own lawyer, business manager, etc., and thus it's not uncommon for lawyers to represent both the personal manager and an artist. Most of the time, this isn't a problem. However, if you get into a fight with your personal manager, the lawyer will probably have to resign, or at least resign your side if the manager was there first. And you can't expect him or her to represent you vigorously against the personal manager in making your management deal. In short, there are no hard and fast rules about conflicts. If the lawyer is straight and ethical, you can usually live with their representing a few other people in your life. But if you have a problem with another of your lawyer's clients, you must seriously consider getting separate counsel. And if you just don't like the idea of your lawyer having these conflicts, which is a perfectly reasonable way to feel, get someone who's independent. Conflicts, by the way, are not limited to lawyers. Business managers can have conflicts when they represent both a personal manager and an artist. For example, when there's a dispute over commissions. Managers can have conflicts when they act in some other capacity, such as becoming the producer of the artist's motion pictures and negotiating a fee for themselves that affects what the artist gets paid. Managers can also have conflicts when they have two artists vying for the same gig. Like I say, it's a small business. but we generally work things out amicably. A disturbing thing that's happened over the years is that some lawyers are selling conflicts of interest as a benefit to their clients. For example, they might suggest that you'll get a better deal with a certain record company or publisher because they also represent them. I'll give you my subtle opinion of this pitch. It's utter nonsense. For one thing, if the lawyer is being paid by a record company or publisher for work on other clients, it's human nature to think twice about how hard they want to beat them up and jeopardize a profitable relationship, especially for an artist who will pay them much less. Second, it's unethical for them to use any information they gain representing a company when negotiating against that company, and you can bet the company is neither going to like it nor permit it. So be wary of any pitch along these lines. As I said earlier, it is certainly possible for you to live with a conflict, if you're fully informed and are comfortable that the lawyer will be in your corner. But a conflict is a reason to be careful, not a plus. Accordingly, the issue must be left to the tummy test. In other words, ask yourself whether your tummy feels like it's okay, or whether you're concerned about it. If you're concerned, get another lawyer. Attorney checklist. Here are some questions to ask your potential lawyer. 1. Do you have expertise in the music business? What kind of deals have you done? 2. What do you charge? 3. Do you have a written fee agreement? In California, lawyers can't enforce their fee agreements unless they're in writing, which is obviously a major incentive to have a written contract. If your lawyer requires one, ask for a copy so you can review it. It's unethical in California for lawyers to have an agreement that can't be terminated at any time. If it's a percentage arrangement, be careful about what happens to the percentage after the term. Refer to the discussion of this under Management Deals in Chapter 3. 4. You should ask if they object to your having a fee agreement reviewed by an independent advisor, preferably a lawyer, but at least a personal manager or business manager. No legitimate lawyer will object to this, and in fact, they should encourage it. If it's at all possible, you should have your lawyer's fee agreement reviewed independently, especially if it involves a percentage. If it isn't possible to do this, make sure the lawyer explains it to you in detail and that you understand it. 5. Do you have or foresee any conflicts of interest? 6. Ask for references of artists at your level and check them out. Does the lawyer return phone calls? Do they get deals done in a reasonable period of time? Reasonable in the music business is not going to be anywhere near the speed you'd like. It's not uncommon for a record deal to take 2 to 4 months to negotiate, especially if you're a new artist and can't force the company to quickly turn around their contract drafts. 2 to 4 months is a realistic time frame. But if it goes beyond that, someone isn't doing their job. I've always been amused by a story I heard from a new client when I was a young lawyer. He had been represented by another lawyer, and as he handed me his record deal, he said, "I know this is a good deal. It took over a year to negotiate." Chapter 6. Agents. Role. Agents in the music business are different from agents in the film business. While agents in the film business are the major power brokers in the industry, controlling most aspects of it, agents in the music industry are involved primarily in booking live personal appearances, concerts. Music agents are often involved in commercials, endorsements, tour sponsorship, television specials, and other areas, but they don't participate in or get paid for records, songwriting, or merchandising. Thus, they aren't involved in every area of the artist's life in the way that managers and lawyers are. So even though agents are extremely powerful players, their sphere of influence is limited. Fees. Because agents aren't involved in your recording or songwriting, with the possible exception of film music, as we'll discuss, or your merchandising, you should never give them a piece of the income from these areas. Usually agents don't ask for this, but be careful of union forms, as noted in the next paragraph. Agents are regulated by the unions, AFM, American Federation of Musicians for musicians, SAG-AFTRA, a union formed by merging AFTRA, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, for vocalists and actors on live and digitally recorded media, with SAG, Screen Actors Guild, for film, and Actors Equity Association, for live stage. The unions put a cap on how much the agents can charge, namely 10%. For certain personal appearances under AFM jurisdiction, it can be more than 10%. However, the agents readily agree to a 10% maximum if you ask. The AFM and AFTRA printed forms have a place for you to initial if the agency gets commissions on your earnings from records. Watch for it and never do this. The union regulation of agencies is called franchising, and unions only allow their members to be represented by franchised agents, meaning those agents who agree to the union's restrictions. One of those restrictions is that the agency can only use contracts approved by the union, which results in each union having its own pet form, spelling out that union's particular requirements. So your agency contract looks like a fat coffee table book. Actually, it's a stack of separate contracts, three for SAG, one for films, one for filmed TV, and one for filmed commercials, one for AFM, one for AFTRA, one for Actors Equity, and two, called General Services and Packaging, to pick up everything that isn't covered by a union. Don't tell them I told you, but some agents will discount their percentage to as low as 5% for artists generating major revenues. This is only for concerts. They stay at 10% for films, TV, etc., unless you're a major hitter in those areas, and even then, they may not budge. Sometimes there's a sliding scale, so that as your income goes up, the percentage goes down. The industry goes through cycles as to how easy it is to get this discount, so you have to check out the situation when it's relevant to you. Deal points. The major things to negotiate in your agent's deal are the following. Term. The agency will ask for 3 or more years, and you will want to give them only 1 year. Shorter is better for you, because you can split if things don't work out, or squeeze their commission down if things do. The result of this wrestling match depends on your bargaining power. If you give more than a year, you should have the right to get out after each year if you don't earn minimum levels. Refer to the discussion of this under Personal Manager's Deals in Chapter 3. Agency deals work the same way, except the numbers are lower because they don't represent all areas of your life. If you have some clout, you may never sign any papers at all, although some agencies get snippy about this. Scope. If you're involved in the film business, for example, if you're a musical artist and also an actress, screenwriter, director, etc., and if the agency is in both the film and the music business, the trend is for agencies to insist on representing you in all areas. Thus, an agency representing you in the film business will require you to sign with them for your musical concerts, and vice versa. This may or not be to your advantage, and it becomes more negotiable as your bargaining power increases. Some agencies have a firm policy and won't let you in the door without a full package. Others are more flexible. Exclusions. Similar to personal manager's deals, refer back to Chapter 3, you can exclude certain monies from commission. 1. As we just discussed, you can exclude earnings from records and songwriting without any difficulty. However, some agencies try to commission your soundtrack album royalties if the album is derived from a film in which they got you work as an actor or actress. I try to resist this, and I've been pretty successful for established artists. The agency's main argument is that if you have no career as an actor or actress, and the agency is instrumental in creating one, they should get paid on everything you get from being involved in the film. If you do agree to this, make sure it only kicks in if you're getting a major part in the film. It isn't fair for an agent to commission your earnings from musical performances. For example, your fee for singing the title song, your soundtrack album royalties, etc., just because you're on screen for 10 seconds to tell the doctor she has a phone call. Your argument is that you don't need the agency to get your music into motion pictures, unless, of course, you do. So they shouldn't be commissioning an area in which you already have a career. Their argument is that if they move you into a new arena, acting, and the soundtrack album is merely an aid to doing it, they should get paid on everything. Results vary with bargaining power. There are agencies that specialize in getting motion picture musical work for artists. In that case, of course, the agency will get commissions on your fee for writing music and/or singing, and your record royalties as well. They normally don't commission songwriter performance royalties, which are monies we'll discuss in Chapter 16. 2. You should exclude things like book publishing, if you're so inclined, merchandising, and record producing. You should also try to exclude commercials, though this is getting harder. Even in excluded areas, however, the agents will want to get paid if they find you work. I like to say they can't look for employment in these areas without your consent. That way, they don't come running in with a basket full of offers if you aren't in the market, or if you just don't want them involved. 3. You can also exclude costs of collection before applying the commission, as we discussed in Manager's Deals in Chapter 3. In other words, if you have to sue a deadbeat to get paid, you should deduct the cost of the lawsuit from your recovery before the agent gets his or her commission. Termination of the agency. As we just discussed, your agency deal is a stack of union forms. Each of these union agreements has a clause saying you can terminate if the agent doesn't get you work, or an offer of work, for 90 days. Since these are separate agreements with separate terms, you want a provision that says you can get out of all these deals if you have the right to terminate any one of them. Without this, the agency would represent you in some areas but not others, because they all have different termination criteria. This clause is a bit hard to get if you only work in the music area. Since you've never had a film career, the agency can reasonably argue that they can't be expected to produce one in 90 days. The usual compromise is to say that if the AFM or AFTRA agreement, the ones covering the music area, can be terminated for failing to get you work, then you can get out of everything. Territory. If you're a new or even mid-level artist and you're based in the United States, it's difficult to give an agency less than worldwide rights. If you're a non-U.S. artist and already have a deal outside the U.S. with another agency, this isn't so difficult. Even for U.S. artists, however, you can sometimes exclude territories outside the United States if you have enough clout. This is often beneficial because you can hire agents in Europe or elsewhere who specialize in those markets. In fact, some U.S. agencies use a local sub-agent for foreign territories, and you can thus eliminate the middleman. The major U.S. agencies, however, all have their own shops over there. At a high enough level, you might even eliminate a foreign agent altogether and deal directly with the concert promoters through your lawyer and personal manager, if they have the expertise. On the other hand, even if the U.S. agency uses a sub-agent, they don't just sit there idly while the sub-agent does all the work. The American agency oversees the foreign agent and makes sure the shows are properly promoted, that you get paid on time, etc. It's also easier to deal with someone locally than to get up at strange hours and call around the world. Double commissions. Just like personal management deals, there should be no double commissions if you have a corporation. Refer back to Chapter 3. Picking an agent. If you have a personal manager, you'll have only occasional contact with your agent. You may meet when you first set up your tours, and you'll see them at your shows, where they'll tell you it's the best performance they've ever seen. The rest of the time, he or she talks to your personal manager, and to a lesser degree, to your lawyer and business manager. Thus, picking an agent should be primarily handled by your manager, since he or she deals with the agent most of the time. But you should make the final decision. If you don't have a manager, the agent will report directly to you. In this case, the criteria for picking your agent should be the same as picking a manager, so refer back to Chapter 3. As always, make sure you get a good vibe from whoever you're hiring. Part 2. Record Deals. Chapter 7. Broad Strokes Overview of the Record Business. Industry Structure. Before we get into the various moving parts of record deals and discuss whether you even want one, let's first talk about how records make their way from the oven to your table, well, tablet. There are several designer methods to choose from. Major record companies. There are three major record companies in the world today, and each owns a set of labels. They are Universal, Interscope, Republic, Capitol, etc., Sony, Columbia, RCA, Epic, etc., and Warner, Atlantic, Warner, Elektra, etc. In addition to these mainstream labels, all three of the majors own independent distribution companies. More about those later. In prior editions, I included a snappy little chart that showed the major divisions of record companies. Maybe I'll bring it back in the next edition, but currently, several of the record label departments are shifting around like staircases at Hogwarts. That's because the transition to streaming has caused traditional jobs to morph into new ones, as well as morph into each other, meaning everyone is still scrambling to figure out what the record company of the future looks like. In particular, the line between what used to be the sales department, getting retail stores to buy physical records, plus making sure they're displayed prominently, and the marketing department, getting consumers to go into stores and buy the records, has gotten fuzzy in the digital world. For example, when someone places an ad for your song on the front page of a streaming service, it took a relationship with the streaming service to get that ad in a prime location, traditionally a sales job. But the ad is directed at consumers, traditionally a marketing job. So is that under the sales department or the marketing department? Moreover, the departments doing these jobs aren't the same at the different labels, either in name or function. So I ditched the record company org chart. Okay, with all that in mind, let's move on to the promised lesson in record company anatomy. Let's start with the departments that haven't changed in the new world, meaning jobs that aren't related to how music is delivered or marketed. A&R. These are the people with ears who find and nurture new talent and who work creatively with the artists. Refer to Chapter 11 for a discussion of A&R people. Nowadays, they also work with the company's data geeks to catch new music that's starting to trend. Promotion. These folks live solely for the purpose of getting your records played on the radio. They spend their days jamming radio stations and saying, "dude," "baby," and "sweetheart" a lot. In the digital world, radio is less important than it used to be, but it still matters. Radio helps build an artist's visibility in general, and the streaming companies are more open to featuring your music if you're happening on the radio. Finance. They compute and pay your royalties, bless their little hearts, and keep track of the company's income and expenses. They also deal with audits, which we'll discuss in Chapter 12. Business affairs / legal. These folks are responsible for the company's contracts, not only with artists, but also with digital service providers, foreign licensees, and more. Historically, business affairs people negotiated the deals and, in conjunction with other executives, decided what to give and what to hold. Then, the legal department gave legal input and negotiated the contracts. Due to industry cutbacks, business affairs and legal are now almost always the same people. International. As the name implies, the international department coordinates the release of your records around the world and oversees everything happening in foreign territories. With some companies, marketing is now global, so there's not a separate international division. Catalog. There is a separate marketing department for older product, called catalog product. Film/TV. This department hounds people to use the company's recordings in movies, TV shows, and commercials. It's also called a sync department, which we'll discuss in Chapter 17. So much for the survivors. Now let's take a trip to Fuzzy Valley. Historically, the other record company departments were sales, selling and shipping records to stores, making sure your product is displayed prominently, marketing, publicity, album cover artwork, promo videos, ad campaigns, etc., production, manufacturing, printing covers, etc., and product management, a point person in charge of making sure the other departments all did their jobs for your record. This worked nicely when we were dealing with physical product, but as you know, physical product is now a vampire with a wooden stake in its heart, throwing off a few last twitches. So here's what these jobs look like today. As we discussed, marketing departments traditionally reached out to consumers, and salespeople reached out to record stores. Since the stores of today are the digital service providers, called DSPs, such as Spotify, Apple Music, etc., sales and marketing departments are now divided on the basis of who they're going after. Specifically, marketing people deal with consumers, and salespeople deal with the DSPs, like they did with stores. Here's some more detail. The marketing departments have different names at different companies, but are usually called something like digital marketing. Their job is to hype your music to consumers through website design, social media marketing, etc. They also track social media engagement and collect data on how your music is trending. Are more and more people streaming it? Is it falling off a cliff? Similarly to the way sales departments shipped physical records in the past, today's sales departments are responsible for all the technical function around digital files, such as correctly encoding metadata on the masters. Metadata is the embedded information that tells the name of the song, artist, album, who to pay, etc., and delivering digital files to hundreds of DSPs around the world. Most important, however, is that salespeople push the DSPs to maximize streams of your music. For example, sales folks try to get you featured on the DSP's homepage. They also try to get you on playlists, and as I understand it, playlisting is a pretty complex area. For example, you don't want unknown music too early in a playlist. Listeners skip it, and DSPs keep track of which songs are being skipped so they can dump them. But you don't want your song too late in the playlist, because people stop listening before they get to it. Their goal is to drill your music deep enough into a subscriber's brain so that it ends up on their personal playlist. That way, they keep listening to your music and making you money long after the record was released. This is known in the industry as lean back, meaning that someone is listening to their own playlist or a DSP-created playlist, as opposed to lean in, where they're actively searching for new music. As for other departments, product managers now handle the logistics of things like TV appearances or Facebook and Spotify promotions. Production now plans releases, meaning they get together final edits of the music, credits, delivery to the DSPs, etc. Some companies also have a strategic marketing department that finds endorsement and sponsorship opportunities for artists and takes a percentage of the deals. Finally, we come to distribution. The major record companies' records are all distributed by major distributors, which are gigantic distribution networks that are owned by the major labels' parent companies. These distributors coordinate digital distribution and move physical records from manufacturing plants into the stores. They also report streaming data to the record labels. Independence. Independents are record companies that aren't owned by a major, and they come in two main flavors. True independence. A true independent is not owned by a major label, either in whole or in part, and is a fully functioning record company on its own. Examples are XL, Merge, Epitaph, and Victory. True independents generally distribute their records through independent distributors, which are set up to deal with the specialized needs of independent companies. though some larger independents distribute through major label distributors in a few situations. Strange as it sounds, most of the big independent distributors are owned by the same companies that own the major labels. Specifically, Red and The Orchard are owned by Sony, Caroline is owned by Universal, and ADA is owned by Warner. See Figure 1 in the PDF. Major Distributed Independent. This is an independent entity that has little or no staff, but rather signs artists and makes a deal with a major label to perform many, sometimes all, of the functions beyond recording the records. These companies may be truly independent in ownership, or they may be owned in whole or in part by a major record company, such as Sub Pop, which is partially owned by Warner. The primary thing these companies bring to the party is the ability to find talent and then mercilessly beat the distributing company to make sure their product gets promoted. Product released by these companies may be on the independent's own label, or it may be on the distributing company's label, in which case the public may never know the independent company exists. This type of entity is discussed in detail in Chapter 14, in connection with independent production agreements. A related chart can be found in the PDF, Figure 2. Note that retailer means streaming services like Spotify and Apple Music, digital stores like iTunes and Amazon, and the disappearing physical retail locations, which are called brick-and-mortar locations, like Walmart. A word about retailers. At the time of this writing, brick-and-mortar record retailers are on the endangered species list, waiting for their appointment with Dr. Kevorkian. The pure record store is virtually extinct because there's not enough CD and vinyl business left to support it. A few independent stores are hanging on, but even they have to sell posters and other merchandise to stay afloat. There are some oddball places, like Urban Outfitters, that sell vinyl and even cassettes, but overall, vinyl is less than 2% of the business. And as the CD's heartbeat continues to slow down, it's hard to see how anyone, other than maybe a few specialty shops, can survive in the long run. Today, most of the CDs and vinyl in the United States are sold by Amazon and big box retailers, so named because their stores are in the shape of gigantic boxes. Specifically, Walmart and Target handle the biggest chunk of the physical business. I use chunk in the smallest possible sense. As CD sales continue to shrink, these big boxes keep cutting back the number of CDs they're willing to carry in their stores. In fact, as I write this, most of them only carry the top-selling titles. In addition, these stores are cutting back the amount of floor space they're willing to devote to CDs. That's because they want to get the most money from their real estate. And if selling vacuum cleaners is more profitable than selling CDs, the dirt suckers win. All this, of course, becomes a vicious cycle. If the stores carry less product, CD sales drop even more because there's less available to buy, which means the big boxes cut more floor space, which means even fewer sales. There's, of course, no doubt that streaming is the game of the future. At the time of this writing, streaming accounts for more than 75% of recorded music revenues in the United States and is growing rapidly both in A, overall dollars because of added users, and B, as a percentage of overall sales because, in addition to streaming dollars getting bigger, physical sales and downloads are shrinking fast. If you want the most current figures, take a look at the RIAA website. RIAA stands for Recording Industry Association of America, which is an industry group formed by the record companies, www.riaa.com/u-s-sales-database. You might ask why you need a distributor for streaming. Can't you just license your music to Spotify and be done? Well, you'd have to license all the services, and there are quite a lot of them floating around the world. And even if you did, it takes a lot of effort to stay on top of all those licenses. The major labels have hundreds of employees to do that. However, you can easily get your music on all the DSPs through services like TuneCore or CD Baby, More about them later in this chapter. And they'll handle the licensing and tracking, which makes an artist wonder if they need a record company at all, and which happens to be our next topic. Do you need a record label? Historically, record companies held the keys to the kingdom. It took a large organization and a lot of money to manufacture and ship records to stores. You needed manufacturing plants, warehouses, sales forces, shipping people, freight charges, financial controls, etc. Also, in order to really sell records, you had to get your music on the radio, which took a promotion staff and a lot of money. In those days, the record retailers were so big that they wouldn't bother with small players. That meant, if you didn't come through a major record company, it was hard to get your product on their shelves at all. Also, frankly, the big record companies paid retailers a lot of money to position their product prominently in the stores. So even if an artist managed to get their records into the retail bins, they'd likely get buried in the back. If somehow an independent artist's records started selling anyway, the retailers would pay the artist late, if at all, since one little player didn't matter to them. On top of all this, the artist would have to put up the money to manufacture the records, and if the stores didn't sell them, they'd be returned to the artist, who'd lose the manufacturing costs plus the freight costs in both directions. So putting this all together, you can see it took a big player to absorb these risks. Well, Dorothy, we're not in Kansas anymore. 1. While it's still difficult to get your physical product into stores, now it's because the stores carry so few titles, brick-and-mortar retailers are way less significant, as we just discussed. And as we also discussed, it's easy to get your music distributed digitally. 2. Radio is still important for mainstream artists, but less so than it used to be. Also, radio has become a very narrow channel. In other words, it plays only a limited range of music genres and not a lot of different titles. That's because radio stations aren't in the music business. They're in the advertising business. And their sweet spot is attracting 16 to 24-year-olds, so they only want to play music that brings in those folks. Because of this, alternative ways for people to discover music have become more important, and streaming playlists are quickly becoming the new radio. 3. As we discussed in Chapter 2, a direct relationship with fans is the next generation of marketing, and young artists are proving savvier in this area than a lot of established companies. On top of all this, as you'll see shortly, when you make a deal with a record company, you give up control of your recordings, as well as other aspects of your life, such as the ability to do music for films, commercials, concert videos, etc. And you also give up a chunk of your income from both record and non-record areas, which we'll also discuss in a bit. So why would you want a record company? Well, if you're a niche artist, for example, a jam band or backpacker, and you're happy staying in your niche and selling to a small group of fans, you may not need or even want a record deal. As we discussed, it's easy to get your music to Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon, Pandora, and other digital outlets through outfits like TuneCore and CD Baby, who we'll discuss in a minute. And you can make a living doing gigs, promoting yourself directly to your fans and selling your tracks. Because your genre limits your potential audience, you'll often make more money by doing it yourself than you would if you signed to a record company. For a record deal to make sense, the company has to generate more money for you after they take their piece than you would get by going it on your own. With niche artists, that's often questionable. If you're more mainstream, such as hip-hop, pop, or country, this is a much tougher question. You can set up a killer web presence, build a fan base, and market to them. Since your music has a wide appeal, if you break through, you'll make far more money by keeping the record company's share of the pie, not to mention keeping all your non-record income. But here's the problem. The same way that it's easy for you to set all this up, it's easy for everybody to set this up. At the time of this writing, there are more than 10 million artists on SoundCloud and Facebook, and who knows how many on YouTube. How's anyone going to find your music? There are some virtual record companies who can help. These companies were started by talented people who left record company jobs when the industry melted down, and they'll do everything from sales to marketing, promotion, etc., under a deal that lets you keep complete control. However, they charge pretty heavily for these services, which most new artists can't afford. Thus, they've mostly been successful with artists who've already released a few albums, and therefore have a decent-sized fan base. DIY or not to DIY? If you decide you want to release your own music, known as DIY in the biz for do it yourself, you can easily get it on all the digital services through sites like TuneCore and CD Baby, who charge a flat fee per year. TuneCore provides only digital distribution, but CD Baby will sell physical product for a flat fee per CD. At the time of this writing, CD Baby charges $4 per CD. You set the price to the public and keep the balance. However, they have a minimum order of 50, so you're taking the risk that they don't sell, meaning you pay $4 per CD whether it goes out the door or not. And unlike TuneCore, CD Baby also charges a percentage of the money from downloads. The Orchard, owned by Sony, will also do both digital and physical, but they are much more selective about what product they take. The Orchard takes a percentage of revenue, and they also charge a setup fee. For the most current pricing and services, check out their various websites. When your music is available, it doesn't help much if no one knows about it, and there's a lot of competition for consumers' attention, as we just discussed. So you have to get the word out by using the same techniques and online resources we discussed in Chapter 2, in the section on Building Your Buzz. You might want to review those if you're going DIY. Hurry back. Don't leave me dangling here. As of this writing, most mainstream artists still want to sign to a record company. Apart from guaranteeing you money, so you can avoid sleeping on park benches while creating your music, the record companies have the resources to get your music heard above the noise of all the other artists out there. They have staffs of people with experience in marketing and promotion, relationships with streaming services that can get your music featured, and radio relationships that can get you airplay. Also, the major labels have massive amounts of data from all over the world, which they use to develop strategies. So for these reasons, a lot of artists choose to go the label route, and this even includes artists who do quite well on their own. A common pattern is for an artist to get to a certain level, then move to a label, because they feel they need the company's resources to take their careers to the next level. Having said that, more and more artists are doing extremely well on their own and may decide to stay that way. The future in this area will be very interesting, so stay tuned. Assuming you want a contract with a record company, let me show you what those babies look like. What's a record? Let's start with a real basic. What's a record? Interestingly, in virtually every record agreement, the contractual definition of record includes both audio-only and audio-visual recordings, meaning recordings with both sound and visual images, such as music videos. Surprisingly, this language has been in deals since the 1960s, which is before video cassettes and DVDs were even invented. Also dating back to those early days, the definition of records has also included, and still does, any other device now or hereafter known that is capable of transmitting sound alone, or sound with visual images. And even more important, the current deals define records to mean any kind of delivery of your performances for consumer use, whether sound alone or with visuals. This language is designed to ensure that the company has rights to mobile, internet, and whatever else comes down the pike. As you'll see later, these broad definitions in record deals can make life a bit tricky if you're a recording artist and also an actor or actress in films. Stay tuned, or take a listen to the beginning of Chapter 12, if you can't wait. By the way, did you know that originally, records were made by having the musicians and singers perform for each record sold? That's because there was no mass duplication process in those days, and thus the recordings were made directly onto the wax that was ultimately sold, meaning every record in a store contained a unique, one-time performance. Can you imagine how sick you'd be of a song that sold a million copies? Masters. The word master has two meanings. One, the original recording made in the studio is called a master because it is the master, meaning the original, from which all copies are made. Master recordings are now almost entirely done on computer hard drives, and the recordings are multi-track, meaning that each instrument and voice part is recorded on a separate track, the drums on one track, guitar on another, voice on another, etc. When the recording is finished, the master is then edited, mixed, and EQ'd. As in films, editing means cutting out the parts you don't like and splicing in the parts you do. Mixing means getting the right level for each track, so that the drums are the right volume during each particular part of the song, the voice is raised a bit on the chorus, etc. Also, as part of mixing, the sounds may be enhanced through processes I have never completely understood. EQing stands for equalizing and means that the bass, mid-range, and treble are each adjusted to the right level, so that no one of them overpowers the others. The mixed multitrack is then reduced down to a two-track stereophonic master, which is ready for the duplication process. You may have also heard the term stems. Stems are the individual track recordings of each instrument and each vocal, usually in the two-track stereo mix form that's used in the final record. You need stems for remixes, which means, not surprisingly, a new mix of the original record, such as a dance mix, club mix, radio mix, etc. You also use stems when you perform live to the track, or when you use a different version of the master, for example, without the vocals in an audiovisual work. So there are two masters, the original multi-track and the finished two-track. 2. The word master also means a recording of one particular song. Thus, you might say an album has 10 masters, meaning 10 selections on it. These individual recordings are also called cuts because of the historical process of cutting grooves into vinyl for each song. Royalty computation. Enough about art. Let's talk about money. We'll start with your royalties. Basic concept. My brother-in-law, Jules, was in the used car business. He was famous throughout the West Valley because he'd trade cars for anything. At one point, he traded a car for a silver tea set, a set of golf clubs, and a mule. Honest. He then traded the mule, along with a stained glass window of Daffy Duck, for an English bulldog named Rosie. About that time, my wife and I were looking for a dog. It was before we had children, and we wanted to test our parenting skills on something that wouldn't use drugs if we failed. In trying to decide what kind of dog we wanted, we used to take Rosie for outings on weekends. In a perverted way, we began to think of her gnarled face and drooling as cute. Anyway, Jules decided he was going to breed her, and we wanted a puppy. So I helped him find a stud dog through a sophisticated referral system, the Yellow Pages. For you youngins, Yellow Pages were the internet in those days. I called a place named Royal Family Bulldogs, which conjured up images of some country squire's dogs lounging around on velvet pillows. It turned out to be a dilapidated house in Pacoima, the most impressive feature of which was its bulldog smells. But Royal Family had a brown and white champion stud named Winston, so Jules hired Winston, and Rosie got pregnant. After a few weeks of this, Jules decided he wasn't interested in the headaches of small puppies, so he enlisted the help of his friend Corky. Corky's deal was that she would take care of Rosie and the puppies, then when each dog was sold, she'd get half of the sales price. So if a dog sold for $200, Jules would get $100 and Corky would get $100. What does this have to do with records? Well, your record royalty is very much like Jules' share of the Bulldog proceeds. In the case of records, the artist, Jules, turns the recordings, Pregnant Rosie, over to the record company, Corky, who then monetizes the finished product, Puppies. For each record, Puppy, sold, the artist gets a piece of the money, and the company keeps the rest to cover its costs and make a profit. See Figure 3, Bulldogs and Royalties, in the PDF. Basic royalty computations. The division of proceeds between the artist and record company is a bit more complicated than the Puppy deal. In fact, for many years, this process was more complex than NASA's formula for getting the space shuttle home. But then, in a surge of, why can't we all just get along, the company shifted to a much simpler system. You get off easy. I had to learn all the complicated crap. I included a section on how it used to work in Appendix A at the end of this audiobook, titled Ye Olde Royalty Calculations. It's only included because, one, there are a number of older deals written this way. Two, I spent hours writing that section and hate to see it go to waste. And three, even though I know nobody ever listens to anything titled Appendix, I thought you might need it some night if you have trouble sleeping. And now we return to our regularly scheduled programming. To follow this next part, we'll need to use a little math. Don't worry if numbers aren't your strong suit. I'll go slowly. I explained these concepts to my cousin David, who has to take off his shoes and socks to count to 20, and he understood them. Here's how it works. 1. For streaming, it's just like the Bulldogs. The artist gets a percentage of what the record company receives for streaming your recordings. This is really as straightforward as it's ever been in the business. The early accounting magicians, who found many ways to screw artists while smiling at them, must be rattling in their graves. In other words, if the company gets $100 from your recordings and you have a 10% royalty, you get $10. There are, however, a few bumps along the way to figuring out how much money your percentage applies to, and one particularly important issue around foreign streaming that we'll discuss in a minute. The basic streaming economics work like this. A. Each month, the streaming services count their total streams. Just to pick an easy example, assume that all the music on Spotify had a total of 1 million streams last month. They actually have billions. I'm just using numbers that make for simple math. B. Next, they look at how many of those streams were your record company's masters. If your company had 300,000 streams that month, it would be 30% of the 1 million total streams. C. Spotify next looks at their total revenue for the month, subscription money and advertising revenue. Let's say that was $1 million. They divvy that up among the record companies on the basis of how many plays came from each company's masters. In our example, since your record company had 30% of the total streams, they'd get 30% of the $1 million, or $300,000. By the way, there's some controversy around this calculation, which we'll discuss in Chapter 12. D. The record company then looks at the number of streams of each of their artists. Using our example of 300,000 streams for your company, if you had 60,000 of those streams, you'd be 20% of the record company's streams for that month. C. Accordingly, 20% of your record company's $300,000 revenue from Spotify would be allocated to your masters, $60,000. F. The record company then applies your royalty rate to the $60,000 attributed to your masters. So if you had a 10% royalty rate, you'd get 10% of $60,000, or $6,000. Again, these numbers have nothing to do with reality. They're just simple numbers to make the math easier. Major streaming artists can make multi-millions from streaming, even after taking out the record company piece.